This episode of Morbidology is sponsored by Yarn, an interactive storytelling app where stories are told as text messages between the main characters. It offers everything from true crime chat fiction stories to even choosing your own adventure. They have series such as Mystery Dog and Haunted Camper, but my favourite has got to be their latest podcast, Strange Street, where you follow the main character, Cece, into a mysterious alternate universe. It had me guessing the entire time. So if you love true crime podcasts, then Yarn is the app for you. Tap through the most addictive and immersive stories today, only on Yarn. Trust me, with over 27 million downloads, Yarn is a must play. Download Yarn for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Y-A-R-N. Download it today to watch, read, and listen to all of your favorite fiction stories. From steamy to horror, Yarn has it all. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Armada is a quaint and quiet village in Macomb County, Michigan, with less than 2,000 residents. It's most known for its country fair, as well as the Halloween festival, aptly named Armageddon. In 2019, it was named the nicest place to live in Michigan. It's the kind of area where people typically leave their doors unlocked, and murder is something you hear about in the newspapers for big cities. But then one warm summer night, a tragedy took place along a picturesque recreational trail, which would cause irreversible damage to the community. In the aftermath, the community bonded together to ensure that justice would be served. It was a pleasant evening on the 24th of July, 2014, when a young couple decided to go rollerblading and cycling along the Macomb Orchard Trail in the Macomb County village of Armada. They were passing a section close to a residential area near Fulton and Depot Roads at around 8 p.m. They noticed a dog that appeared from the woods. She rushed over to the couple, then rushed back into the wooded area. She did this several times, and it became quite obvious to the couple that the dog appeared to be trying to alert them to something. They followed the dog into the woodland, and she directed them to the body of a young female. The dog lay down beside the body and began whimpering. The young female had been dumped in a drainage ditch, around 20 feet from the trail. The couple immediately called 911.
911?
Yeah, I'm fairly certain we just found a body along the mountain bike trail.
Is it a male or a female?
Female.
About how old do you think she is?
I didn't get that close.
Okay. Is she on the trail?
No, she's off the trail, tucked back in the woods, her clothes are all taken off.
Okay, and you don't believe she's breathing?
I don't believe so, no.
The body was quickly identified as 14-year-old April Millsap, and it was announced that her death was being investigated as a homicide. However, investigators didn't initially release her cause of death. They released a statement which said that they were searching for a grey van that had dents along the side, which was occupied by two white males. They didn't elaborate whether the men in the van were considered suspects or persons of interest, just that they were wanting to track them down and identify them. April's mother Jennifer was called down to the police station for an interview with investigators so that she could walk them through the rest of the day.
What can you tell me about April?
She's a good girl. She pretty much does what she's told. Typical teenager. She listens to me pretty much. She knows not to be out after dark.
And what'd she do for the rest of her day?
She spends most of it playing on her computer.
Okay, all right. What else did she do today other than play on a computer?
Took the dog for a walk, but that was the last thing she did.
And you were absolutely positive she had her phone with her?
Yes.
And so when she left, did she say where she was going?
She didn't say exactly the path that she was going to take, but she usually goes to the trail over by the greenery over there.
Okay, so top to bottom, what was she wearing?
A pink top and light blue jean shorts with a black stripe on the inside.
Jennifer informed investigators that April had taken her dog, Penny, for a walk just after 5:30 p.m. that evening, which was typical routine for April. When April still hadn't returned from the walk around an hour later, her mother and boyfriend had started to become concerned and called local police. While it was still light outside, April usually didn't stay out for that long. As they searched for April, her boyfriend came across police on the Macomb Orchard Trail. April lived at home with her mother, Jennifer, her stepfather, David, and their border collies, Penny and Bella. She was the only child of Jennifer and Bobby, and she would often spend the summer months with her father in Indiana. She'd been a pupil at Armada Middle School, and she loved poetry and was excited about starting high school in the fall. Jennifer said that April was always good at writing and wrote a number of short stories when she was in the 4th and 5th grade. In middle school, April was a member of the band and played a percussion instrument. She and her boyfriend, Austin Albertson, had been dating for 18 months. At just 14 years old, 18 months is a lifetime. She and Austin were the very best of friends, and quite often, Austin would meet her on the trail and they'd walk Penny and Bella together. As Jennifer said, Austin is a good kid. April and her family were regulars at St. Mary Mystical Rose Church, and April attended every youth group meeting. In fact, April had been instrumental in getting the youth group off the ground. April was an animal lover and had ambitions to become a veterinarian. Her grandmother, Linda Millsap, said, "She was a very sweet, wonderful child." Just the day after the discovery, investigators announced that April's autopsy had been conducted. It confirmed that April hadn't been sexually assaulted. While investigators had a cause of death, they decided to withhold that information. Armada Police Chief Howard Smith said that the family had been informed and stated, "When we find the individuals responsible, we want to be able to compare statements." He also once again reiterated that they were looking for two occupants of a grey van. It was described as a painter's type van and said that an eyewitness in the area at that time had described it to investigators. He further announced that they were also searching for a small blue and white motorcycle, which was being operated by a young male wearing a black helmet on the Macomb Orchard Trail. In addition to searching for the van and motorcycle, investigators were conducting a canvas of Armada Village, as well as the neighbouring communities. In addition to local police, they were assisted by state troopers, sheriff deputies, and FBI officers. The assistance was very much needed. After all, Armada only had one full-time officer and 9 part-time officers. In such a small community, rumours regarding April's cause of death began to swirl throughout the neighbourhoods. April's grandfather, Dennis Levans, briefly spoke with the media and said that Jennifer had told them that when she viewed her daughter's body, it was apparent that she had been beaten and stated that her face was bruised black and blue. He went on to say that there were rumours that April had sent a vague text message to her boyfriend, Austin, while she was walking her dog on the evening of her murder, which indicated that she feared that she was about to be abducted. As Dennis said, "I've heard you can manipulate those messages, so we're not sure how much credibility it has." Lieutenant Michael Shaw of the Michigan State Police said that they were unable to comment on these rumours due to the fact that the investigation was still very much open. April's parents pleaded on television for any information which could lead to April's killer or killers. Her mother Jennifer said, "She did not deserve to die like this. Please tell people don't ever think it cannot happen to you. We would have never expected something like this to happen to us." The family were keeping busy, and Jennifer's close friend, Debbie Shanta, said that they were grateful of the community support. The community really rallied around the family, even those who didn't know April or her parents. April's murder completely terrified the entire community. The Macomb Orchard Trail was a popular recreational trail. Every single day, people walked their dog there, went for a jog there, or cycled there. It was a well-travelled area, and it was still light outside when April went for a walk there with Penny. In fact, Armada Village had not had a murder in 7 years. Despite the fact that a young girl had been murdered in broad daylight, Chief Smith said, "We believe that this was an isolated incident. We don't believe that there is any immediate danger to the public." A grief counselling session was scheduled at Armada Middle School from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. for staff and students. That afternoon, a memorial was held for April at St. Mary Mystical Rose Church, where April was a regular. Joe Sturza, a youth minister, told those in attendance how April was just coming into her own. He said that when April first came to the church, she was very introverted, but said that she had come out of her shell and was beginning to blossom socially as well as grow in her faith. He said, "My heart is broken. I know the community of Armada and St. Mary's is devastated." A prayer service and candlelight vigil was to be held on the Saturday evening, where the church clergy would be available after the service to talk to anybody who may want to discuss the tragedy. Around 250 people attended the service. April's best friend, Madison Adams, fought back tears as she recollected fond memories of her friend. Brooke Gardner, who was another friend of April, said that she had met her through Hope for the Day, which was a non-profit organization using art as a defense mechanism to suicide. She said that April was always wanting to be involved and was always looking out for other people. She also said that she would not be using the Macomb Orchard Trail until April's killer was caught. Katie Gabrowski fondly recalled how April always had a smile on her face and made friends with everybody that she spoke to. A number of April's friends spoke with 7 ABC News after the vigil.
April was the kindest girl anyone could meet. She was friends with everyone and she had a wonderful and beautiful personality.
Her smile. She had a gorgeous smile. She was a gorgeous young lady. Even on her bad days, she would try to make everyone else around here feel better. And, you know, that's one of the things I'll never forget about her.
The following day, investigators released a composite sketch of a tall white man who they referred to as a person of interest in the murder of April. He was described as an average height or taller with sandy brown or reddish hair. While releasing the sketch, Chief Smith confirmed that April had sent a text message to her boyfriend that evening, which read, "Oh my God, I think I'm being kidnapped." He urged anybody to come forward with any kind of information, no matter how insignificant they may think that it is. He said that the man in the sketch had been seen in the area around the same time that April vanished. He further said that they had consulted with FBI experts, who said the potential suspects may have shown an excessive interest in the case, or may have unexplained absences from their regular activities. He reminded locals that the suspect may have changed their hair, or may have grown facial hair in a bid to conceal their identity. On the Friday, April was scheduled to be laid to rest. Before her funeral, there was a viewing at Tiffany Young and Haas Funeral Home, where the funeral director, Art L. Haas, said that the community was really pulling together during the tragedy and offering support and condolences for April's family. Donations had been collected for the funeral while pink bows were tied to trees as a beacon of hope and support along Main Street leading to Macomb Orchard Trail. A concert was held as part of the Armada Music in the Park Summer Series, where a donation bucket was placed out, and all of the proceeds would go to April's family. During the visitation, many people wore pink in honour of April, while her family wore t-shirts with the words Armada, Angel, emblazoned on the front. In fact, Penny, who was April's loyal companion, had some of her white hair coloured pink, in honour of the best friend whose side she refused to leave. According to family members, Penny hadn't been the same after April's murder. Afterwards, April's funeral was held at St. Mary Mystical Rose Catholic Church. Her body lay at the front of the church in a brown casket. Investigators have been working on the case around the clock, from the moment that April's body had been discovered. As is protocol in any murder investigation, those closest to April were interrogated and investigated first, including her parents and her boyfriend, but it was quickly announced that they were not considered suspects. Before the month of July came to a close, investigators announced that they were no longer looking for a grey van, but were still wanting to identify the man with the motorcycle who was seen on the trail. They announced that they were confident that they were zeroing in on the suspect. Following the announcement, it was noticed that a house was being raided in Wales Township, around 15 miles northeast of Armada. According to neighbours, a man who lived in the house owned a blue and white motorcycle, which had seemingly vanished. One neighbour, Mike Freely, said, "Since this happened, I really didn't realise that until this started happening. Don't see the motorcycle." The FBI and Michigan State Police were seen carrying out bags of evidence, while two men were arrested. They soon enough announced, however, that the raid was in relation to a marijuana grow operation. Members of the Armada Homicide Task Force set up checkpoints along roads leading into Armada and stopped drivers as they entered or exited. They asked if they had been in the area on the 24th of July, and then wrote down the names of the motorists as well as their addresses. FBI Special Agent David Porter said that they were going back to the area of interest and the same time frame as when the murder had taken place, and were trying to find anybody who may have additional information or tips. He said that as soon as it was announced that two men had been arrested in the area, the tips had essentially stopped, and once again he reiterated that the two men hadn't been arrested in connection with April's murder. The two men who were arrested would be identified as 66-year-old registered sex offender James Bernard Van Callis Sr. and his 32-year-old son, James Donald Van Callis. They were both held on $75,000 bail, and both had a criminal record. In 1995, James Sr. was convicted of criminal sexual conduct, second degree, with a person under the age of 13. In 1995, he was convicted of criminal sexual conduct, fourth degree, with a person aged 13 to 16. James was twice convicted of a felony or an attempt to commit a felony for breaking and entering a building in 2005. In 2012, he was convicted of failure to pay child support. While the two men had been arrested for a marijuana grow operation inside their home, their neighbours had said that James owned a motorcycle similar to the one that investigators had been searching for. James had a medical marijuana license and was allowed to have 36 plants at home. However, when the home was raided, 52 plants were discovered. In early August, April's cause of death was finally publicly released. She had died of blunt force trauma and asphyxia due to neck compression. That evening, another vigil was held for April in Armada. A large crowd of friends, family, and strangers gathered and released lanterns into the sky. At 8:20 p.m. Just the following week, it was announced that a second search warrant had been executed at the home of James Sr. and James. They appeared in court where it was revealed that James was a person of interest in the murder of April. James Sr. was additionally released on bond. Their attorney, Dean Ancooney, stressed that their case had nothing to do with the murder of April, adding that the family felt as though they had been harassed. He said, "My clients are very disappointed with the way the police have handled the investigation. They feel the police are harassing them, and they feel they have left their house ransacked, even though my clients have been cooperative from the beginning." While the investigation was still underway and James was behind bars, investigators once again returned to the area where April was murdered, and the surrounding area searching for clues. They used sticks to search through the dense underbrush, and while their presence was extremely evident, they refused to elaborate on why they were back in the area, searching or what they were searching for. As the search was underway, James's attorney stated that he wouldn't be surprised if his client was charged with April's murder, stating, "We feel the prosecutor is zeroing in on the wrong person." As foreshadowed, in early October, it was announced that James Van Callis had been charged with first-degree murder, murder during another felony, and assault with intent to commit sexual penetration. Prosecutor Eric Smith said that there was physical, eyewitness, and electronic evidence, which placed James at the scene of April's murder. In a statement, alongside April's mother and stepfather, he said, "As the investigation progressed and intensified, the evidence led in only one direction." He revealed that there was a video which showed James with April's cell phone, and that all evidence would be presented in due course. According to the details of the case provided to the district court, investigators believed that James had approached April on the Macomb Orchard Trail and tried to talk to her, prompting her to send the ominous text message to her boyfriend. It was speculated that James then followed April and ambushed her from behind, beating her over the head with his motorcycle helmet. According to the documents, James then dragged April into the woods, where he stripped most of her clothing off and continued to beat her and stomp on her. A shoe imprint on April's body matched a pair of shoes that James owned. Furthermore, James had allegedly tried to sexually assault April, but was interrupted by a witness on the trail. The court document said that James then stole April's cell phone and her backpack. James was ordered to be held without bond, and he pleaded not guilty. Judge Dennis Leduc agreed with Assistant Prosecutor William Cataldo that the murder met the heinous standard for bond to be denied. Judge Leduc presented a number of files from James's previous offences. They included 4 offences for driving with a suspended license, 2 for malicious destruction of property, throwing items at a train, larceny under $200, larceny under $100, impaired driving, and drunken driving. In May of 2007, James had written a letter to the court in which he pleaded for relief from probation bills. He wrote, "I pray to the court that you can please help. I'm trying to get my life back together, but I do need your help." As the news of the charges swept throughout the area, locals let out a collective sigh of relief. The community had been on edge at the idea of a child killer lurking among their reputable residents. Many people were wondering, could it be someone they know? Carolyn Sweeney, who owned a local bookstore, said, "I hope it gives some peace to April's mother. I hope it starts the healing." While Leah Bugby-Wolowski, who owned a local hair salon, said, "I feel it was a great thing that happened today, but I don't feel like justice will be served until they bring back the guilty verdict." Towards the end of the month, James and James Sr. both pleaded guilty to manufacturing marijuana. James would be sentenced to 1 year in that case. Shortly thereafter, it was announced that James would be getting a new defence lawyer, because his family could not afford to keep using the one that they had hired. The judge said that he would move to have a court-appointed attorney in place as soon as possible, and just 4 days later, he was appointed as our Sikh. HelloFresh cuts out the stresses of meal planning and trips to the grocery store. If you're like me, you always end up buying produce that you don't use. With HelloFresh, you can enjoy cooking and eating and get dinner on the table in just 30 minutes or less. You can select from over 23 recipes each week, which feature a range of flavours and ingredients, so there's something for everybody. You can also easily skip any week you don't want a HelloFresh box, or change your delivery date. With HelloFresh, eating good could not be any simpler. I got my first HelloFresh box recently, and my favourites so far have been the roasted pepper and aubergine linguine, and the turmeric roasted cauliflower. Each meal comes with a recipe card, which is super easy to follow. I know that for me personally, I always get into a rut when it comes to making different meals each night, and HelloFresh takes that away. I'm a vegetarian while my other half is a meat eater, and HelloFresh caters to us both. They also offer meals for those who may want to be eating a bit healthier, with low carb and carb smart options, as well as pescatarian options. It's easy to see why HelloFresh is America's number one meal kit. Go to HelloFresh.com/Morbidology10 and use code Morbidology10 for 10 free meals, including free shipping. That is HelloFresh.com/Morbidology10 for 10 free meals. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and they're today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counselling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counselling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counselling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counsellors specialising in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counsellor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. In December, a hearing was held to determine whether James should face trial for the murder of April. During the hearing, Mary Stein and William Buchanan identified James as the man they had seen with April shortly before her death. Both of them testified that they separately saw James acting strange on a motorcycle as they rode on bicycles past him and April. Mary said that as she and her husband cycled past, April appeared nervous. She said that she thought the situation was strange and that James looked angry, but she just thought that maybe he was an older boyfriend of April or even her stepfather. William testified that he rode past April, who was slightly off the trail. He said that he then spotted James and he looked surprised and nervous as he cycled past him. A third witness, Eric Riche, testified that he also saw April but couldn't identify the man because he was wearing a motorcycle helmet.
How close is the motorcycle to April?
It was right next to her. It was in the middle of the trail.
Basically, then how close were the two of them?
Within 2 feet of each other.
Did you hear a conversation between the two?
No, I did not hear
it. Did you, I guess, see a conversation between the two?
From their body language, it seemed like they had been talking.
During the hearing, it would be revealed that April had been using a cell phone fitness application while out on her walk with Penny. The prosecutors presented a video on Google Earth with the data from the application. It showed the phone first travel through a subdivision north of the trail, and then east and back west before April was attacked. But then the video is interrupted to a near stop, and slight movement for about 15 minutes. It was evident that this was from when April was fighting for her life. At 6:44 p.m., the phone's path suddenly restarts at a high rate of speed, from 20 miles per hour to more than 30 miles per hour. According to the prosecutors, this was because James had stolen April's phone and driven off on his motorcycle. The path of the phone then went east on the trail to Fulton Street, then to Main Street in downtown Armada. It then moved to Omo Road, where it stopped near a long driveway in the 73,000 block of Omo, around half a mile from where April was attacked. April's phone would be discovered on the 25th of July by a sniffer dog. More phone evidence would place April and James together on the trail between 6:25 p.m. and 6:44 p.m., the time that she was murdered. During the hearing, it was also revealed that April had dialed a phone number three times shortly before her death. The intended recipient of the phone call was never identified, but it was revealed that April placed the three calls just minutes after she sent the text message to her boyfriend. Testimony was also heard from Matthew Sadage, who had found April's body with his wife. He said that Penny had alerted them to her body, stating, "As we went past, the dog was just down in the ditch and was whimpering." He said that April's skirt was down at her knees and her shirt was pulled above her chest. He said it was obvious that April had been beaten to death. His testimony was followed from Officer Morgan, who said that it was evident that James had intended on raping April, but was disturbed. He said that her left eye was heavily swollen and there were abrasions and bruises to her neck. James's girlfriend, Crystal Stadler, testified that James had left their home on his motorcycle at around 4:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. on the 24th of July. She said that he returned home between 9 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. and said that at some point between 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. the next morning, she woke up in the middle of the night and found James cleaning the exterior of his shoes with a sock and hand sanitizer. The next day, he told her that he had been cleaning oil off his shoes. Crystal had a three-year-old son with James, and said that the following night, police spoke with him at his home, and he said to her that he had messed up and needed her to stand by his side. Because he was acting strange, Crystal said that she had checked a hoodie that James had carried in his backpack when he went out on the 24th of July, and found pieces of grass or hay and wadded up hair, which was the same colour as April's hair. It would also be revealed that investigators had received 1,000 tips from the community in the days following the murder. The judge would determine that there was enough evidence for James to be sent to trial. He said, "The court particularly noted the very strong, very clear identification of Mr. Van Callis as the motorcyclist with Miss Millsap on the trail. I also specifically noted Millsap's phone remained at the murder scene for approximately 15 minutes. And left at speeds varying from 25 miles per hour to 35 miles per hour, not a pedestrian." Shortly after James was ordered to stand trial, he was moved to a mental health unit of the county jail. Attorney Seek said, "He's very depressed and despondent about the charges and things being said about him." He further said that he didn't think that the prosecution would be offering James a plea deal, and even if they did, he wouldn't accept one. Judge James Bernard Sr. would subsequently refer James for a psychiatric evaluation to determine whether he was fit to stand trial. The evaluation would rule that James was fit to stand trial and could assist in his own defence. Afterwards, the trial was scheduled for September of 2015. By this point in the case, there had been plans for an April Millsap Memorial Garden along the Macomb Orchard Trail, where April lost her life. However, during a meeting of the Macomb Orchard Trail Commission, officials said that the proposed project did not comply with their policy. The policy was adopted by the commission just moments before Jennifer was scheduled to give a presentation on the memorial garden. The garden plan had been put together by Julie Reich, who was a family friend. Jennifer hadn't been made aware of the decision, and she started to read out an emotional letter about her daughter, but was interrupted and informed that the idea was nice, but the memorials went against their policy. The decision was a crushing one to the family and Julie, who said, "Why work with me and keep sending me back to the drawing board on it, if you were just going to not approve it? They should have told me it wouldn't work out and I would have moved on months ago." Macomb County Executive Mark Hackle stepped in and said the county, which owned and maintained the trail, would work to make the memorial happen. He criticised the Macomb Orchard Trail Commission and stated that they could not decide what goes on county property. The following month, the memorial was unveiled. It was going to be a 14,000 square foot garden with a bell, benches, a butterfly garden, a bike rack and a bike repair station. It was near where April's body was discovered. Jennifer placed a vase filled with flowers at the base of the antique bell and said, "April liked nature and she enjoyed walking on the trail. I think she would have enjoyed this." The memorial was completed shortly before the one-year anniversary of April's murder. The murder trial was then pushed back to January of 2016, when the lead prosecutor, Therese Tobin, left the office to take a federal government position as an administrative law judge. During the opening statements, Prosecutor William Daly said, "April's head and neck. She was stomped to death. She was literally beaten and stomped to death. Within minutes, April is assaulted. April was taken to the woods just north of the trail, and April was murdered." During the defense's opening statements, defense Sikh said that there was no physical evidence linking James to the murder of April. He boldly stated, "I think if they would have waited until the lab results and the helmet results came back before charging Mr. Vincalis, we wouldn't even be here at all." He went on to suggest that the eyewitness testimony was unreliable and said that the biggest injustice would be for the actual culprit to go free, while an innocent man be convicted. The first person to testify was Jennifer. She described spending 10 hours in the police station following April's murder, but wasn't actually informed that her daughter was dead until the following day. She said that at 2 p.m. she was shown a photograph of April's body by an FBI agent. In court, Jennifer identified April's cell phone and black backpack, which was carrying a bottle of water and dog treats. Penny's retractable dog leash was never found. These items had been discovered within a mile of the crime scene and had been discarded by April's killer as they fled on a motorcycle, as indicated by the fitness app April had on her phone. Her testimony would be followed by Detective Sergeant Raymond Petchman, who said that he spotted a motorcycle parked outside a home around 23 hours after April was killed. The black, blue, and white Enduro matched the description of the motorcycle that the eyewitness had described just hours before. He said, "I was driving down Armada Ridge Road, westbound, headed back to the command center, and spotted the dirt bike in the driveway. I snapped a couple of pictures with my cell phone, and snapped a photo of the address and went back to the command center." The home belonged to James Muse, who confirmed to the officer that the motorcycle belonged to James. They tracked James down and interviewed him on the front porch of his home. And then the following day, an FBI agent spoke to James once more. He said that James cooperated and told a consistent story in both of the interviews. However, he refused to provide a written statement. He told the officers that he had left his home at around 5:30 p.m. on the 24th of July, before going to look for his brother, Don, first at his home in Armada and then at Tim Horton's home in Romeo. He said that he then returned to his brother's home before leaving for his own home just before dark. He said that on the day April was killed, he was wearing a Carhartt hoodie, camouflage pants, and white K-Swiss gym shoes. The following day, Detective Petchman called James and asked him for a written version of this statement. He said that this time, James's attitude had changed significantly.
He was very upset to the point where he was irate on the phone. He was yelling at me on the phone, telling me that it was a witch hunt, that we are trying to call and talk to all kinds of people and take people's cell phones.
He told the jury that James was upset to the point that he was irate and accused the officer of a witch hunt. The video created with the data from April's fitness app was once again played out. It showed April walking for a distance before turning around and heading back towards her home. Moments later, she texted her boyfriend saying that she almost got kidnapped. Her pace increased, and as the prosecutor suggested, this was April trying to flee from her initial contact with James. Then from 6:31 p.m. and 6:33 p.m, April's phone dials an 810 area code, which has never been identified. It was unknown whether April or her killer had her phone when the phone calls were placed. Moments later, and until 6:44 p.m, April's phone moves in short zigzag patterns within a short circular area. The prosecutor stated that this was when April was being beaten to death. The phone then suddenly leaves the area at a high rate of speed. It was evident from the speed that whoever took April's phone was driving a motorcycle. A car couldn't be driven down the trail. Eric Resch, the man who saw April on the trail with a man on a motorcycle, would also be called to testify. He told the jury that he saw a man around the same height and weight as James riding a motorcycle alongside April, minutes before police believed she was attacked. He said that James's helmet looked like the helmet the man was wearing. He said that he believed that he was wearing a backpack but couldn't be 100% sure. Under cross-examination, the defense argued that Eric had never seen the man's face and could not say with certainty that it was James's motorcycle that he saw. The jury would then be shown graphic photographs of April's body, while Officer Philip Neumeyer took them through the crime scene.
Blouse and bra were pulled down about her waist area. Her blue shorts and undergarments were pulled down to around her ankles.
He said that April's blouse and bra had been pulled down to her waist area. Her blue shorts and underwear had been pulled down around her ankles. He said that there was blood on April's body and on a tree nearby, and also said that they didn't find any motorcycle tracks. While the attack had been a brutal one, there was very little blood at the scene, which could be common for some beating deaths. The detective said, "The reality is, it is possible to commit a very serious crime, and you don't have a lot of blood at the scene." Forensic scientist Michael Kislitsky said that there was no DNA from James found at the crime scene. He then took the jury through the crime scene photographs and testified about the scene as well. During cross-examination by Defence Seek, he hammered home one of his main points, that there was no evidence of James at the crime scene. Michael stated that any contact between people or people and an object result in transfer of material, and agreed with Defence Seek when he said, "Would you expect something from the assailant would have been left behind?" Before stating, "Sometimes culprits leave a trace, but sometimes things get lost." He also said that items can decay and disappear over time. The jury would also hear from medical examiner Mary Petranglo, who testified in regards to April's injuries. She said that the injuries that April had sustained were similar to injuries that one would sustain in high-impact motor accidents. She detailed that April had suffered from bruises, abrasions, and abraded contusions to her head and face, which caused bleeding throughout her brain. She then detailed 9 additional injuries to April's neck and her upper chest area. She said that April had died from blunt force trauma and asphyxiation, and said that marks left on April's neck and face were consistent with somebody stomping with a shoe. She agreed with the prosecution theory that April could have been beaten to death with a motorcycle helmet. Under cross-examination, Defence Seek said that James's helmet had no dents or blood or dirt on it, and Mary stated that the helmet very easily could have been washed, and said that the helmet would have been hitting soft tissue. She further stated that the reason there could be potentially no DNA at the crime scene was if the first blow to the head knocked April unconscious. That way, she wouldn't have been fighting back. Chief Smith would be called as a prosecution witness next. He told the jury that they had located Nike Jordan Air flight shoes, the type of shoes that James often wore, according to his girlfriend. The pattern on the bottom of the shoe matched those imprinted on April's back. While he was being cross-examined, it was revealed that a composite sketch of the suspect looked nothing like James. The composite showed a man with curly hair and a clean-shaven face, while James had short hair and a moustache and goatee. Defence Seek said that this showed that James had been misidentified by several witnesses. Those witnesses would testify about what they had seen on the trail. William Buchanan had cycled past a man who he identified as James, alongside April on the trail. He told the jury that James looked extremely suspicious. He said, "I looked him in his eye. His eyes were so wide, I thought he was angry or scared." He said his first thought was why somebody was on the trail on a motorcycle, and that James had been a short distance behind April. He was asked how sure he was out of 10 that who he saw that day was James.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how certain are you?
It's a 10.
Why are you so certain?
Look him in the eye.
He said that he looked the man in the eye, and said that he clearly saw his moustache. The defence ordered James to put on the helmet to try and show that there was no way that William could have identified James when he was wearing the helmet. William complained that James was wearing the helmet during trial at a different angle than what he was wearing it on the trail. Prosecutor Cataldo then produced a selfie of James in which he was wearing his motorcycle helmet, and you could clearly see his face and moustache. He complained that when James put on the motorcycle helmet in court, he pulled it up so that it concealed his face more. Also testifying was Amy Spinella and her mother Gail, who said that they were riding their bicycles on the trail around the same time as the murder. They said that they saw April with Penny walking west. Moments later, they saw a man on a motorcycle pass them from behind and turn the motorcycle around a short distance in front of them and go west. They continued riding east past Omo Road. When they were riding west near where April's body was found, they saw the same motorcycle parked on the south side of the trail with nobody near it. Amy said that she saw a black helmet resting on the handlebars. As they rode on, Amy said that she turned her head north and saw a man standing in brush off the trail, around 15 to 20 feet away from her, and he was standing beside a dog.
I made eye contact with the person that was out there. His eyes were very, very piercing, very, like he had done something wrong.
Amy testified that she made eye contact with the man, and his eyes were piercing. She said he looked as though he had done something wrong. She said that he was a white male and estimated him to be younger, around 14 or 16 years old. She said that he had his hands extended downwards in front of him. Gail, who was riding ahead, stopped to let Amy catch up. Gail said that she didn't see the person, but suggested going back. Amy said to the jury, "I said, absolutely not, we're going home. I said it very sternly." The next day, she learned of April's murder from her father, and immediately she asked if there was a dog there. When her father said that there was, Amy went straight to police. She said on the witness stand that she could not identify James as the man she saw, but also couldn't disqualify him. Their testimony would be followed by Mary Stein, who said that she was 100% she saw James with April on the trail before her murder. She and her husband had been cycling on the trail when she saw April walking Penny. She was walking towards Mary and away from James. Mary said that she said hi to April and she replied by saying hi back. However, she said that April gave her a tight smile, which looked like she was very tense. She said around 45 feet away, she then cycled past James. She said that she greeted James, but he didn't respond. She told the jury he had an angry look on his face and he looked down. I thought, of course, it was rude, but I thought the entire interaction seemed very strange. I wondered whether it was an older boyfriend or stepfather, or they just had a fight. Mary also said that when the composite sketch was released a few days later, she was upset because it looked nothing like the man that she had seen. She said that the suspect's hair in the sketch was too curly and it made him look much younger than she believed he was, which was around 30 or his early 30s. She said that she complained to police, but her input was never sought. She said that when she saw James on the TV after he was arrested, she recognized him immediately as the man she saw on the trail. James' ex-girlfriend, who testified at the pre-trial hearing, was also called to testify during the trial as well. Crystal Stadler told the jury that in the middle of the night after April's murder, James told her that he messed up and needed her to stand by him. She once again spoke about waking up after April's murder to find James cleaning his shoes with hand sanitizer. Later, she went to wash the hoodie that James had been carrying in his backpack on the day of April's murder.
Did you find something unusual in the Carhartt jacket after you washed it?
Yeah.
What was it that you found?
Like wadded up hair and like shavings of grass or like hay.
After police spoke with James, he told Crystal that if they ever spoke to her, to tell them that he was wearing K-Swiss shoes that day, despite the fact that she was sure that he was wearing Nike shoes.
What was he telling to everybody in the house?
To tell them that he was wearing K-Swiss shoes.
Was he wearing K-Swiss shoes that night?
No.
A photograph of James wearing Nike Jordan shoes, which investigators identified as the brand of shoes April's killer was wearing, was presented during trial, and despite an exhaustive search, these shoes were never found. The hoodie that Crystal had seen was also never found. Crystal said she was so convinced that James had killed April that she moved out on the 29th of July. She said that when she left, James warned that he would take her down with him. She admitted that she didn't reveal all of the incriminating evidence until her third interview, because she was afraid of James and his family. She said that James was controlling during their relationship, and he had physically abused her before as well as mentally abused her. He had forbidden her from having a driver's license or a cell phone, and wouldn't let her have the password to the computer. Prosecutors would additionally reveal during trial that James had Googled, "Do girls like older men?" "How to have sex with a girl?" and "How to attract younger women." He had further searched for, "Why would this girl say I'm too old for her but still hit on me?" as well as searched for how to hypnotize somebody. His phone also showed that he was at or near the crime scene at the time of April's murder. One of the final prosecution witnesses would be Donald, James's brother, who lived in Armada. He told the jury that James had come to his home after 7 p.m. to pick up some money. According to the prosecution, this gave him more than enough time to murder April. He admitted that when he first spoke to investigators, he lied about the time that James had arrived. First of all, telling them that he had arrived at around 6:25 p.m. He said his brother appeared to be normal when he arrived at his home. when James was first approached by police. He contacted his brother and told him to delete all of their phone interactions. Following his testimony, the defense once again reiterated that no DNA evidence linked James to the murder. The prosecution responded by saying that even James's own DNA was not found on his helmet, which indicated that he had evidently scrubbed it clean. The defense requested the case to be thrown out due to lack of direct evidence, but the judge refused and said that there was a significant amount of circumstantial evidence against James. During closing arguments, the prosecution once again ran through all of the circumstantial evidence against James. Attorney Steve Kaplan stated, "Why would an innocent person encourage his girlfriend and brother to falsify evidence?" He said that James's Google searches showed that he had an interest in younger girls, and suggested that when he approached April on the trail, he took that opportunity. He showed a photograph of April's hand, which was clutching a wad of grass. He also displayed a photograph of a dried tear stain on her face. He said that while the hair of the composite sketch did not match James, the eyes, ears, and mouth were a perfect match. Defense Seek once again highlighted the fact that the case was completely circumstantial and suggested that the eyewitnesses were influenced by media reports. He went on to compare the case against James to the Salem witch trials in the 1690s. The jury were now sent off to reach a verdict. After 7 hours of deliberation, they found James Vincalis guilty of first-degree murder. As the verdict was read out, there was an audible gasp in the courtroom before tears and the sounds of joy emanating from April's loved ones. Outside of court, a spokeswoman for the Millsap family said, "Justice has been served." James would be sentenced to life in prison without parole. Jennifer was given the opportunity to address James.
"James, I don't know why you did what you did, but my question to you is why. What did they probably do to you for you to be so brutal with her? Do you even know her? What was your plan for her that night? Why did you have to hurt her? Just because she ignored your advances, did she deserve to die? What made you so darn special? I hope you can never sleep without dreams tormenting you. I hope you can't ever eat because you have no appetite. I hope the rain pierces you like bullets. I hope the sun burns you like fire burns skin. I hope the four walls close in on you and choke you. I hope those steel bars are your only friends. I hope when you close your eyes, you see only April over and over and over again. You will die behind those bars, alone. I hope that the inmates know exactly what you did, because I hear their punishment can be very ugly. I hope they save all their rage and anger just for you. You, James, are a damn thief. You stole my beautiful daughter's life, and you stole the rest of mine. April was a beautiful, kind, giving, and loving young lady. She was loved by all that knew her and all those that she touched. She was beautiful both on the inside as well as the outside. You stole her future and all that she had to give from her and the rest of this world."
Speaking of April, she said that James stole her chance to experience the milestones that most girls anticipate. She said, "You stole her chance to experience being a wife and a mother. You took from us the joy of seeing her grow. I will never get to see her graduate, go to high school and college. Following her victim impact statement, James was given the opportunity to speak. He took the opportunity to once again claim that he was innocent.
There is no evidence that shows that I have done anything wrong. There is nobody that can say they've seen me commit any crime on July 24, 2014. There is nobody that can ID or has ID'd my motorcycle as being on that trail that day. None of the witnesses could positively identify me. They said that they seen eyes, which is, if that's the case, how many people have eyes that are that shape? Nobody said that they seen a color of eyes. Nobody positively ID'd my motorcycle helmet as being the helmet that they seen that day. Nobody sat there and ID'd the clothing that I was wearing to exact. Nobody ID'd the shoes that I was wearing to exact on that day. This is a sad chain of events that somehow I'm wrapped up in. I don't know how to have the Millsap family understand that I don't know her. I've never met her. I never seen her before.
In 2018, James attempted to appeal his sentence twice. Both times, his appeal was rejected when a 3-judge panel unanimously ruled that there was enough evidence to convict James. Then in 2019, he attempted to appeal his sentence once again. And once again, his appeal was rejected.
When I found out, I'm kind of numb. Mostly pain, but yeah, it's anger. So why did this happen to me? And I try not to blame God for it, but yeah, why? Why is my biggest question? Why?
April Millsap was targeted and attacked when doing something as simple as walking her dog. Her murder was a chilling reminder that young women can be targeted by predators at any given time. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, the murder rate of juveniles is subsequently higher in the United States than any other developed country. Homicide is the second leading cause of death for people between the ages of 15 and 24. While April didn't know it at the time, she ultimately was instrumental in solving her own murder, simply by turning on her fitness application and hammering the nail in the coffin of James Vincalis's freedom. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbid Ology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a big, massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Edna Millay, Sarah Abraham, Lee Foley, and Brie Lawson. In return for your support on Patreon, you get Morbidology merch, which includes t-shirts, stickers, pins, badges, and fridge magnets. You also get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, as well as bonus content from some episodes, ad-free and early release episodes, and you can even request a case for me to cover on the podcast. You can join for as little as $1 a month. There are absolutely no obligations and you can cancel at any time. You can also sign up annually to get 15% off. Big thank you to everybody who simply listened to an episode, commented on an episode, shared an episode, followed me on social media, sent me a message on social media. All of the support is very much appreciated. Can I also ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a show you'd like, and it really makes my day reading them. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing new true crime podcast, DNA ID. Until next time, take care of yourself, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Jody Loomis, Jessica Baggin, Kelly Ann Prosser, Michelle Martinko, Christy Mirak, Carolyn Rose. Do these names mean anything to you? All these people are murder victims whose cases were cold for decades until recently. They were solved by investigative genetic genealogy. This new crime-solving tool is rapidly providing us with the names of elusive killers. But each one of these cases is unique and worth exploring. Each episode of the DNA ID podcast will focus on one newly solved case and look at the story behind the headline. Who was the victim? Who was their killer? And why did this tragic crime occur? It's brought to you by Abject Entertainment, hosted and produced by me, Jessica Betancourt, and co-produced by Mike Morford. Make sure you subscribe to DNA ID today wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single episode.